wgtd.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
If you earned a GED, HSED, or graduated high school more than 1 year ago and have not earned any Gateway Technical College credits, you qualify for a Gateway Foundation New Adult Learner Scholarship. Info at gtc.edu/foundation scholarships, deadline August 4th.
This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist with the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Good morning, and welcome to Community Matters. I'm Laura Sumner Kuhn, your host, and I'm delighted to bring you the second part of a two-part conversation with three wonderful guests in our series of Recognizing Racism. I have with us this morning attorneys Angela Cunningham and Darren Crawford, and Judge Milton Childs. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, we had a very interesting conversation last week about some of your personal journeys. You all are in the criminal justice system somehow, or related to it through your profession. And we talked a little bit both on a personal level and on a professional in professional cases of criminal justice system's flaws, for instance, and also what does it mean to just follow the rules? In many of the instances of police brutality that we've become aware of in this country in the last month, we can sometimes hear white viewers in particular say, well, I don't understand this. Why don't they just follow the rules for those people who have been victimized by police brutality or unjust treatment by law enforcement officers and the courts? And this is a perfect time with three very knowledgeable people who can open our eyes a little bit to why it's not fair to say that, and what the instances really are that many people of color are facing, and what the result is in our criminal justice system. So I'm just going to kick it off by opening up the discussion and letting the three of you kind of take over. If you want to just identify who's talking and maybe address that question of what does it mean to follow the rules if you're a person of color in this country?
Well, I can start. This is Judge Childs. It's very frustrating when you hear individuals say, why don't they just follow the rules? If you look at many of the cases over the last few years of the individuals that were killed or attacked or victimized by the police, most of them were just following the rules. And most, if not all the cases, they were doing things that any citizen of this country would do, you know, whether it's jogging, whether it's playing, whatever you're doing. And all of a sudden, the officers have this interaction with them. And the rules from the law enforcement side is that if you're a person of color, you want to be treated differently than other individuals. And that's how many of us feel in the black community. So what more do you do as a person of color? I mean, you're following the rules, you're doing everything that you've been asked to do, you're cooperating with the stop. Then all of a sudden, it's not you that escalate the situation. In most cases, it's law enforcement that treat you badly, disrespect you, escalate the situation. And again, in most of these cases, the person of color was not fighting back. They, you know, they were totally cooperating, and then the officer kind of went beyond what they should have done in regards to their actions and the person that's injured or ultimately the person that's killed. So when they make that statement, why don't we just follow the rules? I think we are following the rules and we're frustrated with what the rules are, because the same rules that we're to follow, our brothers and sisters that's white may follow those rules, or they may even push the rule even further, and they won't be attacked, they won't be hurt, they won't be shot. It appears that the police are a little bit more patient with them or allow them more leeway in regards to their behavior, or talking back or talking disrespectful to the police officer, unlike the person of color.
Darren or Angela, you want to build on that at all?
I do want to add to that, and I think the juxtaposition, this is Darren, I think the juxtaposition is very important because, you know, even in my experience, when I'm, you know, I'm complying, and I'm actually over complying because I'm trying to avoid it escalating in a way that would be harmful to me as a person, and then, you know, the impact on my family and my community, all those who care and love and depend on me. But then when I see the videos of the many other people that don't look like me and how they're not only able to assert their rights, but they're also able to do it in a way that's not apologetic, very confrontational. In some respects, it does leave this feeling of subhuman. Like, I don't, even though I know and I'm an officer of the court and I'm, you know, a citizen of the United States and I'm supposed to have these rights, I don't have the same ability to assert them, whether mm-hmm. I follow the rule or not.
Mm-hmm. And just to piggyback off of that, I think the problem is, one of the problems, it's multifaceted, it's not just one thing. But officers, when they approach African Americans, they approach with the assumption that the person they're pulling over has done something, or that they're going to be violent, or that they're dangerous. And when you have that kind of mindset, when you engage with someone, you or your whole way that you interact with that individual is going to be different. I think that's the reason why there's no amount of following the rules that could prevent an interaction when someone already has an idea of what type of person you are, and you make the wrong move, and they interpret it one way, and tragedy happens. I think about Philando Castile, the video that we saw of his shooting. You know, he's reaching for his ID, and that's a perfect example of an officer who has already decided what type of person Philando was, and nothing he did was going to take that perception away from that police officer. And that comes back to, I talked about.
Oh, I lost you. Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Now I can.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. And I talked about previously about prosecutors not having proximity to the people they were prosecuting, except for through their interactions on the job, and that brought on a certain perception of the defendants that they were prosecuting. I think that's the same for police officers. If you have police officers who are trained to assume everyone's a threat, and then most of the people that they come in contact with, most of the African Americans that they come in contact with are on the job, and they don't have any sort of personal relationships outside of the job, I think that makes a perfect storm for fear that causes officers to react the way that they do.
So the question itself is an unjust question. Why don't they just follow the rules is a racist question and an ignorant one, in the sense that the focus tends to always be on people of color, as though all the expectation in the world rides on their shoulders without any kind of self-reflection about the systems we've built, the people who enforce them, and the implicit biases or overt racism that has become part of the white dominant culture to begin with. And this kind of cultural understanding or the culture that has been created through centuries is evident in our criminal justice systems and our law enforcement systems. And you see this every day, the three of you, and in your professional work. Talk to me a little bit about what kinds of things trouble you the most, and what kinds of things that we need to be more aware of to begin to remedy them. And just jump in.
I'll start. For my short stint as a prosecutor, I think what got me really passionate about wanting to address the disparities in the criminal justice system is we often talk about the over-criminalization of the Black community, right? Overcharging, over-prosecuting, over-incarceration. But what you don't hear about a lot is the under-prosecution of white communities or communities from means. And I experienced that personally as a prosecutor, and I was enraged because we charge sometimes, I thought, were ridiculous cases that could have been handled with better resources and better community resources outside of the criminal justice system for Black individuals without any regard about what it would do to their futures, how it would affect their ability to get a job in the future, without discussions about how to affect their ability if they decided they wanted to go to college someday, to go to college. However, you get someone who is white and or of means, and all of a sudden all those discussions get talked about as part of the negotiation and even as part of the charging decision. That was an aspect that I didn't learn until I was at the DA's office, and that is definitely something that, and I'm not saying that that shouldn't be considered for white individuals or individuals of means. I'm saying that same consideration should be made for Black people who come in contact with the criminal justice system, and it's absolutely not a huge frustration for me. And I see it now on the defense side as well.
There's a great deal of discretion all the way along the path that has led to prisons for so many people. And it's not evenly applied. I'm sure, Darren and Judge Childs, you've seen the same sorts of things in your work as well.
Yes, I have as well. This is Judge Childs, and just to add on to what Angela mentioned, the DA's office, they really have a lot of discretion in those charging decisions, and I've seen it as well where a lot of white individuals will get an opportunity to participate in a diversion program that a lot of people of color were not able to. And part of the problem was with a lot of people of color, it's because they had a prior conviction. So supposedly with some of the diversion programs, if you don't have a prior conviction, then it's easier for you to get in those programs. But then you have a person of color who had a conviction when they were a juvenile that's now being used against them as an adult. And is stopping them from getting into a diversion program, which will, you know, again, ultimately may allow them to have a felony conviction, which will have these long-term effects on them. So those are things I think many DAs, the DA's office, need to really look at. I had talked about before, additionally, in regards to the discretion, it starts with the police officers or law enforcement. They have the discretion initially when they pull an individual over to give a ticket, or they can decide to arrest and pursue charges. And again, so many times with people of color, the decision is made that they're gonna take this person to the station, book them, arrest them, and then let some court official determine and ultimately release them. And then a lot of officers make that initial determination in regards to what the charges might be. So now you have a bail set based on what officers feel the charges should be, which could be, you know, a couple hundred dollars of cash, which for some individuals could be pretty hard to post. So those discretionary decisions are made at every level, and the judges have discretion, suppression motions or in regards to unequal sentences. And I think that's where the problem is with the current criminal justice system. You may have individuals who are authentic and not biased, but the system itself is biased. And for so many years, individuals were caught into the system, this biased system, and got trapped into it. That whole thing with truth and sentencing, where individuals were sent to prison and they were going to spend, you know, day for day the amount of time that the judge gave them, that caused that overcrowding of prisons in Wisconsin. They had individuals who had all this supervision time. Another issue becomes that they were revoked from their supervision, so now you have individuals going back to prison based on some behavior that they did while they were on supervision or probation.
It becomes a vicious circle almost, with there being unfair treatment under the law of people of color to begin with, and somebody who's had an encounter with the system, served their time, and is released on probation is more likely to be picked up again given the unequal treatment of the law for people of color just simply for being, as you've mentioned, jogging down the street or driving a car or doing all of the things that we do every day and many of us just take for granted. What a vicious cycle that becomes then. I would imagine too what you encounter is juveniles who have had their first encounter in school and then end up with a record and then perhaps are treated differently when it comes to the kind of discretion that the law could offer in those diversion programs. And by diversion programs, I would imagine you're talking about drug court or veterans court or narcotics court or some of the other ways that we can handle people with a drug and alcohol abuse addiction problems, people with mental health issues, and other more humane ways of helping that person that have become part of the criminal justice system as well over the years, but still is applied differently because of past records, as you've mentioned. Would that be accurate?
Yes, even the deferred prosecution agreement, which can be for other type of criminal charges. Some prosecutors that I've worked with were afraid to even offer that to my clients based on any prior convictions that they may have had. And the reality of it is with the juveniles, I mean, people make mistakes when they're 14, 15 years old, and that they've learned from. And many times they are not given that second chance because of what they did when they were 14 and 15, and now it's being held against them when they're, you know, in their 20s.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to, and just to buttress that point and make it even a finer distinction, the whole point of the juvenile system and the reason why we don't call them convictions but adjudications is to make that distinction, to appreciate that a young child, you know, and during adolescence, they begin to develop. And in their development, they may misstep or make mistakes that we don't want to hold them accountable for when they've reached the age of majority. Now, you know, and so for a system that was created with that presumption to be in fact used to preclude other opportunities, it's about that systemic challenge. Like, once you're in this system, and this is not the only system, I think Justice Judge Milton Childs was saying about the welfare and the CHIPS and how that creates a pipeline to being caught up in the system. And once you're caught up in the system as a person of color, it becomes so difficult. I mean, you had to avoid it, you had to walk on water, right? Mm. I made a traffic turn in an area I was unfamiliar. And so I violated driving laws, right?
Right.
That puts me at jeopardy for something to go completely left. And so in a sense, to avoid having that kind of interaction with the system, you have to be near perfect as a person of color. And then if you're not, which none of us are, and only by the grace of God that I've avoided any issue, but if you're not and you get caught up in it, it becomes a hole that every time you make effort to dig out, you seem to be getting deeper and deeper. And it's not to say that there are exceptions, right? There are some people who are able to do it. But if you look at the rule, most of the time, they're not. And I think, you know, I always pondered this, and I'm glad Angela's on here. You know, one thing I've always wondered is if the way you get elevated within the prosecutorial side, you know, the whole notion of prosecution and you know, the more prosecutions, if that has a bearing on, you know, us over criminalizing non-criminal behavior.
That's an interesting question. Do you have an answer to that?
I don't think there's an easy answer to that. I know from personal experience, when you're in the trenches, it's hard to see the big picture of what's going on. I tried to force myself to do that because I knew what that big picture looked like from outside of the system. Mm-hmm. But I just remember cases coming to you all the time, and there's this pressure to review the cases and make a charging decision. So you didn't, at least, you don't have a whole lot of time to really dig into the case and be creative about anything, or really to think about whether or not this is a good idea to even charge this, even if it is something that in the criminal code is a crime. Is it using your discretion? Is it worth it to charge it when you look at the big picture? So you got the issue of volume of cases that's coming in, and the inability to really sit down and take each one on its own merits in depth in any meaningful way. Maybe at some point down the line you can. I really appreciate it as a prosecutor, defense attorneys who told me background information about their clients, because that helped me get a bigger picture of what was going on. But I guess I'm kind of rambling on, but there's not really a straightforward answer to that. Because when you're actually in the trenches, it's hard to see the big picture.
Sure. I'm also curious about how much pushback do you get or push to charge from law enforcement on the prosecutor side of things?
Oh, man. Yeah. So one thing about Milwaukee is for felony referrals, the police officer who is making the referral actually has to present the case to the prosecutor. And there were times when an officer brought a case. I remember getting into a yelling match with an officer who was trying to push me to charge a case, and I told him no. I told him I didn't have enough evidence to be able to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt, but he was strong in his conviction and thought I should charge it. There was also another incident, and this one, he brought it in for a felony fleeing. The facts of the case were, the officer was stopped at a red light, at a light, and saw another car run the light. Officer went to go pull this car over. Oh, no, I'm sorry, let me back up. The officer was stopped at a red light and saw a car come flying through the intersection. So he was speeding. The car was going really fast, and we have squad cam video, so we could see this car was clearly speeding, even though he didn't have his odometer out to figure it out. So the officer turns on his lights to go after this guy. There's traffic. The officer, by the time the officer makes a turn to follow the guy he's trying to pull over, the guy is way ahead of him, probably by a couple blocks. So officer continues to pursue the guy who sped through the intersection. Eventually, they get to a clearing where there's no traffic. And so then you see the officer start to speed up to catch up to this car, and then the car pulls over once the officer gets closer to the car. And the officer, I don't remember exactly how he explained it in his report, but it was not what I just described. And what I just described is what I saw on the squad cam video. The person the officer pulled over, when the officer asked him why he didn't pull over, he said, "My music was loud. I didn't hear your sirens." Officer did not believe this individual and thought this individual was intentionally trying to flee from getting pulled over. There was nothing else. They didn't find anything in the car. They searched the car. There was nothing else that they could charge him with. And I explained to the officer, I said, as I watched this video, I believe what he said, that he did not hear the sirens, he didn't see you, and based on what I can see in the video, by the time he did realize that you were after him, he pulled over. He was way ahead. He was too far ahead by the time the officer was able to get behind this car, and there was too much traffic for, especially if the guy in the car had the music up loud, for him to realize that the police were trying to pull him over. So that's another officer that was not happy that I didn't charge it. But it's incidents like that where an officer's perception is different than reality, which is why body cameras and squad cam videos are very, very helpful from a prosecution stance.
And probably defense.
From a defense stance, too. But we also know that that's not an end-all be-all either. I mean, how many times have we seen videos of instances that didn't affect the justice or didn't have the outcome that we thought it should have based on what's on the video, based on individuals' perception of what they see in that video?
Judge Childs, when you have something come to your court, how much discretion or a courtroom, how much discretion do judges have to question something when, let's say Angela didn't have a chance to turn down prosecuting this particular instance and it ends up resulting in a charge, and most of these times maybe there isn't a jury involved, it's an argument between defense and prosecuting attorneys. How much discretion do you have as a judge then to push those questions?
Not much, unless the case is being contested. So they can have a court trial where all the evidence would come out. Most time, judges are not privy to a lot of information that the prosecutor and the defense attorney may have. Unless motions are filed, for example, a motion that would challenge to stop. And then the court at that point can determine whether or not the officer had a legitimate stop. But other than that, the true discretion kind of lies with the prosecutor. Then ultimately, the court has some leeway when the person is sentenced at some point, if they are sentenced.
So we have a lot of instances of flaws in our system. What are some of the resolutions that the three of you have thought about during the time in your professions that could be applied or should be considered or we ought to know about, we ought to think about, we ought to do?
One thing I thought about, and what's been interesting in the last couple of months, under this COVID-19, it's forced a lot of players in this justice system to rethink the way things are happening. For example, at this point, more diversions and more DPAs have been offered to individuals probably more than ever before, because one of the goals was to not put more people in jail and to kind of empty out the jail because we didn't want to have more individuals get sick based on the virus. So defense attorneys, judges, and prosecutors have been sitting down and talking through ways to work out cases and to resolve cases and to ultimately divert cases and divert individuals from getting from having charges or reducing charges. So I think that's one way, and I hope it continues after things get back to normal, whatever this new normal will look like, that people actually start talking. Part of the problem is just talking and talking through and talking out cases and trying to determine what's best for justice. And I think that's the way people are looking now. They really are trying to determine what's best in regards to the system and justice, and we need to continue to have those conversations. Earlier this year, I was disappointed. An expungement bill, a new expungement bill, was being presented. It was a bipartisan bill. And right now, individuals 25 and under can have their record expunged for certain misdemeanor and felony charges. And the goal was to have anyone have access to an expungement of their record, again, certain misdemeanor and felony charges, regardless of how long ago it was. And that would have given so many individuals a fresh start. And it was denied, it didn't pass. But I think that's something individuals in the future, when you hear about a new expungement bill coming through the pipeway, something that people should really support. Because again, you know, and we talked about it with Darren, a lot of individuals did make mistakes years ago, and they're on a different track now, and they should be given the opportunity to have a fresh start.
Do you know who sponsored that bill by any chance?
I know from Milwaukee, Goyke was one of the sponsors. I'm not sure who the other individuals were.
That's interesting. Darren, from your perspective as a public defender in Racine, what are you thinking about not only that possibility, but other remedies that could be applied now to make things different?
You know, I mean, that is the million-dollar question, I think, to be quite honest. I mean, I hear the sentiment of defund the police, and I hear that more so as a way to re-envision how we essentially incentivize productive citizenship. That's really what it is. We want to get the most people complying to the rules and being productive citizens. That's the, in my opinion, the aim of any good district attorney's office. And so long ago, we thought deterrence would be the best way to achieve that, you know, by penalizing that behavior. And I'm not sure if history or, you know, what we know from our experience is suggesting that makes a lot of sense. I mean, we're looking at criminalizing more people, incarcerating more people. And what we lose in that is the human capital and resourcefulness and ingenuity. And I look at Racine as a prime example. I mean, some of the things I see criminalized in Racine, and I listen and I talk to these particular defendants, as Angela stated, I get, as a public defender, I get to know their story. And I listen to all that they potentially can, you know, provide the community. And their, you know, and their thoughts about, you know, themselves or their talents and abilities, and it's underappreciated and underrealized for the community, mm-hmm. and we all lose because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when I hear defund the police, I think more of how do we re-envision how to incentivize productive citizenship. How do we remove barriers? How do we, and I, you know, I don't, I mean, part of that, I think that there are some programs that we could do. I think Angela stated having police officers or whomever in the community policing arena involved in the communities and being active. I know in Detroit, they had the PAL League, which was the police officers athletic league, which created connections between police officers and young students and in athletic programs. And so the coaches, in theory, the coaches were the police officers, and the police officers were engaged, and it'd be community versus community in these, you know, football or basketball. I mean, there are ways to try to achieve it. But I think it starts from a realization that, and this is really at the heart of it, that what we're doing isn't working. Mm-hmm. And I don't think district attorney offices have realized that. I don't think writ large legislators have realized that. I mean, you'll have a few here and there, but writ large, I don't think we have realized how epic the problem is, so that we can begin to re-envision. Now, maybe that's changing with George Floyd and some of these other cases, but from my experience, I don't think we have. And even in those cases, you see it movement in most of the major metropolitan areas, but how likely is that to trickle down to a, you know, Racine, which is not a major city? It may happen in Milwaukee, but you have many of these other smaller cities where the same kinds of injustices occur, yet they're less likely to re-envision their or view their behavior or actions as concerning or problematic.
I would say in Racine, the invention of the community-oriented policing program was once envisioned to help nurture those kinds of relationships and neighborhoods that I think you're referring to. Yet as a public defender, can you tell us, if you were to describe the major kinds of criminal charges that come before you as a defense attorney, is there overwhelmingly certain categories of crime that you see Racine citizens being accused of at this time that you question, that where we could apply some different kind of discretion to?
You know what? So obviously I see a great deal, but the ones that are most disheartening to me at times is the charges of sometimes I get charges of criminal neglect of a child. And in theory, you would want somebody to be criminalized if they're neglectful. But in practice, much of what I'm seeing is charged is a poor decision. And we have a whole agency devoted to helping young parents or, you know, new parents or even old parents who had, you know, antiquated practices learn how to do it a different way. I mean, I can, you know, and I'm not going to throw my mother under the bus, but she had three boys and she was a single woman. And so when I think about some of the things she did to keep us in line, they would be, you know, at best a cause for protective service. And maybe in certain counties, she might be charged with criminal neglect or abuse or something like that. And those are the most disheartening, because I'll share this story, and I know this is not story time, but I remember a case in Michigan. This was in Washtenaw County, and it was a mother who she was working very hard, really working very hard, and she was working two jobs, and she had her daughter, she had a younger daughter, and there were moments where she would, you know, leave her daughter, she needed a break essentially, and so she would leave her daughter with the grandmother or with an adult that she knew and that she trusted. And this particular time, she didn't have a cell phone. She didn't have a house phone. I mean, her economic means were, you know, slim, and she was working hard to provide for her child. And so there was this implicit assumption that she would get in contact or she would come back and get her child. Long story short, she didn't come, and the grandmother got mad and upset and wanted to prove, the grandmother of the child, her mother, wanted to get back at her daughter for what she believed was behavior unbecoming, right? Because, you know, she didn't feel if you had a child, you shouldn't do anything but be with that child. Shouldn't have a day or break. You had a child. And so she called protective service, and they initiated, you know, protective services, and they charged her with abandonment and tried to get, and they removed the child from the mother. And, we fought hard, and I knew that mother loved her child, and I had all these people witnesses to that effect. But what was most disappointing is that while that child had been removed from her mother, she was placed in a house where she was molested.
Oh.
And when that point became clear to the guardian ad litem and to the mother, my heart broke, because you took her under the auspices of trying to protect her, and you placed this child in harm when there was never an allegation that she was in any position of harm. It was supposedly abandonment. And the court's position was very cavalier and nonchalant about it.
Mm.
And I think, in some respects, that, you know, and I had to kind of step in, the court kind of said it was the mom's fault. Which added insult to injury, obviously, because she was trying her best to get her child back. And then this happens. And so I say, those are, I think, the most touching to me, because the harm done to that child, the harm done to that mother, in the community, in that family, you know, the mother knowing that she couldn't protect her daughter, and all that she was trying to do was try to provide a life. And she had a moment where she needed a break. And what resulted was, you know, this cascade of horribles that where there's no real accountability from the perspective, you know, from the mother's perspective, no accountability from all the people that were forcing her, trying to get her to be compliant and to look at it a different way. And I think those are, for me, the harder cases, even in Racine, to see the neglect cases and this notion that we are criminalizing behavior that we don't necessarily have to. But there are also some possession cases that I see, possession of marijuana. I see that too often. I mean, it is illegal in Wisconsin, certainly.
But complicated by the fact that it's not in Illinois now.
Elsewhere. And a lot of times they're charged as intent to deliver, which creates it creates the felony, as opposed to the possession, which is just a misdemeanor. Right. And then you have to fight to try to get it down to a misdemeanor if you're going to get it, you know, reduced. You know, those kinds of things. And it's really not. And that's why I asked Angela a question, because sometimes I struggle, like, how do we benefit?
For our discussion, to have a siren in the background. Huh?
Right, I'm sure. But how do we benefit as a society, as a community, as a county, from labeling this young man or young woman as a criminal? To me, that's the fundamental question. How do we benefit from labeling? And there are, to be sure, occasions where that's appropriate, and I'm not saying it's not, but I think too often we are criminalizing things where we can think of a different solution, and the benefit is borne on us all when that person becomes a productive citizen.
Absolutely. I think you leave us with a really good question. And a lot needs to be done. I think so much learning is and advocacy has to happen among people both inside and outside of those systems to push for change. And three of you have helped open our eyes to some of the instances that we see that have been so unjust in our community. I appreciate your time today. I thank you for being our guests, and I hope there's so much we've left unturned that I hope maybe we can revisit some time and carry on more conversation. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.